Well, happy that everybody is here. And as I mentioned, we've been, for those of you who are new, Sarah Mack, you're just joining us, we've been talking about, studying, listening to Dharma talks, and exploring on our own the Buddha's main teachings, the Four Noble Truths. And we started that in January, and here we are on the part of the Eightfold Path. We started with right view, then right intention, right speech, right action. We're now in right livelihood. Nana, one of our team of teachers for Sunday morning, two Sundays ago, and then both Steve Wilhelm and Tim Guile on Mondays, they covered the five areas of livelihood that the Buddha advised against. They're trafficking in weapons, human beings, meat, intoxicants, and poisons. All three of them really helped put those into a broader context. If you weren't able to hear it first time, I encourage you to listen to the talk. I think they should all be up on the website now. And I especially appreciated what Nana said a couple weeks ago when he put this topic into the broader context. He described right livelihood as a portal to liberation. It's where we so fully engage with life. This morning, I'm going to talk about right livelihood in a few ways. You know, we mostly define livelihood as how we make our living, the work we do that we are paid for. And just in terms of time, next to sleeping, we probably spend more time at our jobs than with any activity or people in our lives. This morning, I'm going to talk about three aspects of this. I'm going to have us review just a little bit two of the previous folds of the Eightfold Path that relate to this, right view and right action. Then I'm going to ask a lot of questions about what happens when we're in the workplace. Who shows up? Who are we when we're at work? How do we show up? What's our sense of work ethic that we bring to our jobs? And then lastly, not everybody works for money. Not everyone in our Sangha is currently employed in that way. And so I'm also going to have us look a little bit at seeing right livelihood as right livinghood. So let's start with right view. You know, we strive to work in fields, in jobs which contribute to the well-being of our greater community. But that's not easy. You know, for most of us, we just need to find work that we're compensated for in order to take care of ourselves and our families. If we're fortunate, we can find work in arenas that are meaningful for us personally and make a broader contribution. For those of us fortunate enough to have received advanced training either after high school, even through college or a technical training, we had the intention to get a job that was tied directly to that training. And we want work that's wholesome and that contributes to ourselves and to the wider community. But one way of understanding, I think, right view is to see life as it truly is. And part of that true, clear seeing is we realize that it's nearly impossible to find purity in one's work. We are all part of an economic system and a history that includes and often feeds on killing, stealing, misconduct, and lying. We live in a world where the systems and cultural mores veer away from morality in a regular and consistent way. We live in a world where money is often way more important than the quality of life for its inhabitants. It's wonderful if and when you can find work that is both personally satisfying and contributes to well-being in the world. I ran a recycling company for 25 years. It was good work, a good business. I was grateful for it. I was able to create good paying jobs. I learned a lot. And yet the trucks that we had to use contributed to air pollution and greenhouse gases. So there was no purity there. We also all bring views, opinions, and beliefs about work. My daughter-in-law's dad used to say, there's a reason why work is a four-letter word. He implied that work is a negative necessity in life. I've always had a different approach and have really appreciated my work, even when I didn't especially love it. I've been fortunate in my life to have a variety of work opportunities, none of them connected with my undergraduate degree in Russian political science. I went that way because I wanted to be a spy, which never worked out. Friends used to tease me that I didn't really want to be a spy, but I loved dark glasses and trench coats. Later in my work life, there was some connection when I worked for nonprofits in the city of Seattle that connected to my master's degree, which the focus of that was tying community organizing to food production and distribution. And I felt really fortunate that I had studied on something and then I was able to work in that field. But many of us aren't that fortunate. So in addition to right view, what we also study during our month on right action applies here. We learned that one of the definitions of right action, this came from Philip Moffitt, is any action that liberates the mind, moves you toward freedom from suffering, and supports a feeling of well-being that is independent of external conditions. With right action, we look at what is needed, what's appropriate, what's doable within our own limitations, and what contributes to harmony. Following from this definition of right action, one that supports a feeling of well-being that's independent of external conditions, a good question for us to consider is, am I able to bring right action to my job even when the external conditions at my job are not to my liking? Regardless of where you work, the kind of work you do, or the kind of tasks you perform, we all bring a certain sense of self to the workplace. So I ask us to consider, who is the you who shows up there? Do you come with the attitude, like my daughter-in-law's father, that work is a four-letter word, something just to be tolerated? Do you look forward to your job and what you're able to contribute and to learn? The question is really, how do you show up? What kinds of attitudes and views do you bring to your job? What about your expectations that you hope to receive from your job beyond the financial compensation? What about the expectations that you bring that you want your job to not only give your work life meaning, but perhaps your entire life a sense of purpose and meaning? For many of us, we assume a certain identity associated with our work life. I've shared this before on Sunday morning, that I've been known as the junk lady on Westlake Avenue North, partly because I ran the recycling company and I had all these trucks and all this stuff, but primarily because I was partnered with a junk collector. And Bill's junk was very useful. We built all of our shops with his collection of steel and wood and cable and all that, but there was way more of his collection than we could ever use. So after he died, I cleaned up and I'm no longer the junk lady, but now my business is Pellington Properties. My neighbors tease me, they call me the Baroness of Westlake Avenue, or sometimes they call me the Queen of Pellington Village. And as I prepare for eventual retirement, part of my process is recognizing and loosening the attachment I have to being that baroness or the queen. And if you've enjoyed the work you've done, those kinds of attachments to work identities can be really hard to let go of. In addition, just as all conditioned things change, that includes our work environments, our job descriptions, and the tasks themselves. How do you respond to all those changes? Is your response fairly fluid or filled with a lot of resistance and perhaps even anger? Like, wait a second, this isn't the work I signed up for. Many of us, as I mentioned, we look to our jobs for a sense of value. We fully experience the 8 worldly winds in our workplaces, seeking praise or maybe even fame, sometimes finding blame and disrepute, seeking pleasure from doing interesting or creative work, and often finding, if not pain, at least something we might call humdrum. And why do we behave as we do there at work? Those 8 worldly winds are often alive and well. What do you seek at work? You want to feel good about yourself and your abilities and efforts. And of course, that's natural. We all want to do that. But are the expectations, the additional expectations we bring to the workplace, are they reasonable? Most jobs have a routine, maybe humdrum aspect to them. In the recycling business, I really loved doing it. I liked learning how to drive big trucks. I liked all the physical nature of the job. I liked being able to create good paying jobs for others. But in truth, the work itself was very routine. Apartment buildings were serviced every other week, weekly or monthly. And for drivers, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, the only difference really was which streets you went on. You found the building, you park in a safe spot, you offloaded empty containers, you put the full ones back on, you cleaned up the site, and off you went to the next account. 40 or 50 of those every day. For office workers, each day we produced the routes for the next day. And when new accounts were added or some were removed, we'd have to take steps in the database. But routine was pretty much the best adjective to apply. For me, as the owner, I was able to put all of these routine tasks into a larger picture and felt really good about the nature of my business, keeping all of this material, the papers, the bottles, the cans, out of the garbage, out of the landfill. I felt like we were making a contribution to how we handle waste in the city of Seattle, and we were doing it in a more sustainable way. But it was harder for my employees to really feel that bigger connection. We humans love to be engaged. We humans get bored. But what does boredom really mean? From a dharmic perspective, we might say that boredom occurs when we aren't being regularly stimulated. If we look at our dependence on being continuously stimulated, one interesting thing after another, we might experience the routines at work a little differently. Recently, I don't know how many of you subscribe to Ute Janiyah's daily Dharma thoughts, but recently he had these words to say about boredom. Ute Janiyah is a Burmese Buddhist teacher. He says, "If you take a close look at your experience, you will understand that no two moments feel exactly the same. What makes you feel bored is thinking that you were watching the same thing. But in fact, nothing is ever the same. Every moment is always new. Once you can really see this, your mind will always be interested in whatever it observes. No moment will ever be boring, because your experience will clearly show that things are forever changing." So I invite you to also explore what happens when you feel about your work that it's humdrum and boring. Then let's look at a little more about this question of who shows up at work. What happens when you wake up with a grumpy mind state? It happens to me periodically. And then I ask myself, am I going to bring grumpy to work? Or maybe I can see if I can dig in and find a little more cordial, helpful, and friendly mind state from which to relate to the others at my business. How about how you handle the challenges in your personal life when you're at work? Do you allow those challenges to affect your job? Do you bring them with you? Or do you leave them at home? If your expectations for praise and a sense of worth or even fame come along with you, what happens when you're disappointed? You took a job, and if you were lucky, you were really excited about the work. Things went great for a while, but then things changed. Maybe the business was bought by somebody else. Maybe the mission changed. Maybe the boss who hired you moved on and there's a new director and you don't get along with that person so well. If the work itself is no longer satisfying, do you stay and grumble or do you look for a different job? Or do you work to find some meaning and satisfaction in the work as it newly manifests? Do you have deeply held beliefs about what boss means and what employee means? Is the boss or the owner always the bad guy or the bad gal? Do you have economic, political, or philosophical views about the role of work in a capitalistic society? Are you able to feel a sense of ownership even if you actually are not the owner? How do you still show up as someone who completes their tasks in a skillful and timely and appropriate and helpful manner, regardless of these beliefs? And then there's the question of a work ethic and how that shows up. In preparation for this talk, I asked a whole bunch of friends to tell me about their definition of a work ethic. It was really interesting. Most shared the usual elements, like you do the work to the best of your ability, you get the job done no matter how long it takes. Many mentioned that you bring a sense of ownership to your job and you take responsibility for the quality of the work. If you mess up, you own it. One friend, who's a nurse, shared something that no one else had said. She said that it's really important that you hang in there and develop staying power. And of course, this is appropriate in the nursing field, but she said you have to hang in there because there might be an opportunity that shows up for you to make a difference. And if you don't develop staying power, you might not be present enough to make that difference when the opportunity shows up. Of course, it's true in the nursing field and other healthcare fields, but I think it can be true in a lot of different job arenas. So how does your Dharma practice inform your sense of work ethic? In the Dharma, words like skillful and wholesome, kind and generous, compassionate, patient and truthful are repeated over and over again. How do those qualities manifest in your job, in your work life? And finally, I just want to spend a few minutes looking at right livelihood in the sense of right livinghood, because not everyone is gainfully employed, by gainfully meaning somebody pays you for the work that you do. And if that's your situation, you do not get a pass on this fold of right livelihood. A couple weeks ago at the Clear Mountain Monastery, one of the Ajahns mentioned, he was talking about right livelihood, and he said, you know, monks and nuns, they don't touch money, they don't have jobs for which they receive pay. So for the monastics, right livelihood is really right livinghood. So how do we show up in our lives? How do those qualities that I mentioned of skillful, wholesome, kind, generous, etc., that I was talking about in terms of a work ethic, how do they show up just in your daily life? Are you curious? Are you interested? Do you take responsibility for what happens day to day in your life? What beliefs, opinions, aspirations, expectations do you carry around with you moment to moment? If you're retired, do you focus on right livelihood as what I used to do? What about right now? So this morning, I raised a lot of questions. I don't think I provided any answers. But as I think about this, just as with so much of our Dharma practice, process is what we're involved in. In this case, of how we earn a living, how we show up in those jobs, how we live our lives. This past Thursday, during the drop-in sit, someone brought up a challenge of generosity. They related a situation where they're being asked for money a lot, and all the thoughts and beliefs and practical aspects of how they responded. Well, just like generosity is a process in our lives, so is right livelihood. So I want to leave you this morning with a whole bunch of questions for you to consider as you practice with this fold of right livelihood. And I think the most important question is, how does the Dhamma inform the way you show up at your job? Are there beliefs, opinions, habits which affect how you show up? What about your expectations? Are they reasonable? What happens when you're disappointed? What's your work ethic? Does it need some adjustment or correction so that you feel more aligned between your basic values and how you act at work? And as we have talked about so much for all these months about karma and how everything we do matters, I really invite you to bring that kind of awareness to how you show up at work. I was going to end my talk this morning with this poem that I love. It's one poet's view on the kind of worker person that she really loves. And I'm just going to share it because I've got a couple minutes. It's called To Be of Use by Marge Percy. She says, "The people I love the best jump into work headfirst without dallying in the shallows and swim off with sure strokes almost out of sight. They seem to become natives of that element, the black, sleek heads of seals bouncing like half-submerged balls. I love people who harness themselves, an ox to a heavy cart, who pull like water buffalo with massive patience, who strain in the mud and the muck to move things forward, who do what has to be done again and again. I want to be with people who submerge in the task, who go into the fields to harvest and work in a row and pass the bags along, who are not parlor generals and field deserters, but move in a common rhythm when the food must come in or the fire be put out. The work of the world is common as mud, botched. It smears the hands, crumbles to dust. But the thing worth doing, well done, has a shape that satisfies, clean and evident." I'm going to read that line again because I read it funny. "But the thing worth doing, well done, has a shape that satisfies, clean and evident. Greek amphoras for wine or oil, Hopi vases that held corn, they're put in museums, but you know they were made to be used. The pitcher cries for water to carry, and a person for work that is real." Thank you so much for your attention. And as always, each of us who shares the Dhamma, our hope is that our words and questions, our experience can be of benefit to each of you as you explore this very rich topic. So, we go back and forth between small groups and large groups, and I think we did. We didn't have Sunday last Sunday because of the weekend with Greg Kramer, and I think with Nana we went into small groups. Does anybody remember that? Yes, we did. So, if you're up for it, how about a show of thumbs up for large discussion? And thumbs down for, I will only do thumbs up and down for large group discussion. Because if there's more thumbs down, then we'll go into breakout groups. You get more opportunity to talk. Okay, so I'm seeing 1, 2, 3. Oh, there's one. Okay, Lauren, yours is halfway. I think, oh, well, that was a bad idea. Okay. I hope people will stay. We're going to do large group today. And let me just offer this guideline. A lot of folks who come to Seattle Insight to meditation are basically introverts, shyer. Please know that your questions, your comments are gifts to all of us. Almost always when you bring up something, at least one other person was thinking the same thing. We all really benefit when you share. You're also welcome to not share and to just listen. So I ended with a lot of questions, a lot of hopefully things that will get you thinking more about right livelihood. You are welcome to either, you go down to the bottom of your screen and there's a raise hand. There's a little hand there. If you can't find it, you can go like this. I think I can see everybody. It helps if you bring your video open, if you want to do that. And I'd love to hear how you all are working with right livelihood. And if you've listened to some of the other talks about the 5 areas of work that we should avoid, and I really appreciated all the talks and how they helped us. You know, this is 2,600 years after the Buddha taught. And anyway, it's open. I would love to hear how people are blending their Dharma practice in their work life. Julie, please, thank you for being first.
I like to do that. I feel like I'm easier. I don't mind warming us up. So I'm going to get started by saying I love that meditation. It was so great. I realized I prefer to like not stay with the body most of the time, and I've been really working on that. So thank you very much. Also, you know, I know some people love to take notes during these talks, and I never have, but I found myself thinking, oh my gosh, I wish I had been taking notes because you brought up so much. I just want to say that I have had a very complicated relationship with my right livelihood, having been a person and lived a life where I've had multiple careers and many ups and downs, and I've thrown it all away on multiple occasions and started all over again. And at this stage in my life, my practice is to recognize my job is sitting with humility and practicing the Dharma. And, I just see a bazillion aspects of personality. I wanted to also share with the community that one of the most interesting things that I've learned in my life and my relationship with livelihood is that my previous career, that I went back to school and got yet another degree and started and threw myself into for over a decade, with no, totally great intentions, was so attached to my sense of self that it came crashing and burning in wild flames to the ground, and I couldn't understand. I was trying to save the world, it's just such a rich, rich point of discovery, and I will be listening to all the recordings again. Thank you so much for your contribution, and thanks, Sangha, for listening.
Thank you, Julie. Just, I so respect everyone's willingness to be so real with each other. And I know that I feel safe in Sangha, and I hope that everyone else does as well. I think Charlotte next, and then there are a couple more after that. Please. Are you able to unmute, Charlotte?
Yes, here we
There
go.
you go.
I was at Target yesterday, and I like to observe the people. And yesterday was parents taking their children for back to school shopping. But there was a family, I think there's three kids, and they were playing knock knock, who's there? And so, knock knock, little girl says, dad says, who's there? And dad was responding fast enough, so she gets a little louder and says, knock knock, who's there? So I say, who's there? She looks at me like, what am I supposed to do with this? I don't know this person. I've been told not to interact with strangers. But dad says, oh, thanks for playing. And then we just all moved on. But the look on her face was so precious. It was, what am I going to do next? Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte. Bringing that just kind of general friendliness out in the retail world of Target. Good for you. Yeah, sweet. Thanks. Liz?
Hi. My profession has been, it's been an interesting journey for me. I've been a nurse for 27 years and mostly in, well, a trauma nurse, working within trauma system and for a lot of it in the burn and pediatric trauma system itself as well, either in acute care or an ICU. And it's interesting because I did leave the ICU around 10 years ago. I still work in that system, but it was an actual, it was kind of a moment that brought me into the Dhamma and into the path, because I really had to really analyze where my ego lied and my identity within my profession. Yeah, it was right profession in the sense of I was skilled and doing a really good job at caring for patients that really needed my help. But I was also finding I was taking it outside of my work and not necessarily being, I didn't have the reserves left to be the person that I wanted to be in the world. And that it took a lot of insight and was a vision of impermanence of like where I began and where I began again and again and again and again, just changing always. But a sense of loss and also being okay with that sense of loss is just change. And it, I do reflect back on that now when I still run into challenges at work, you know, that, you know, to sit and see where it's lies within my body and in my mind and where that lies within how I'm following on. Now that I have the more formal structure of the path, I can look into where I need to, where I can find strength or where I need to be real as to, is this right profession at this moment? Mm-hmm. Or what am I, what can I manage to change within my profession? I guess, like you said, that Sue's with the other nurse just hanging in there to see what other paths are there. Livelihood is it's a great place, I feel like, to practice the path. Mm-hmm. You know, you work with, you don't get to choose who rolls in the door, and you just got to treat everybody with the same kindness and empathy and compassion you can. And I'm always grateful for the Dhamma and for Sangha, because you guys really, it's nice to have a safe, warm space to come into that I know is truthful to the path I'm trying to move forward in, always in life. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz, for bringing in two more areas that I never even mentioned. The one of how we bring the work stuff home and the boundaries that we need to, that was one of the things I took from what you shared. And then also that comment, we don't choose who comes through the door. We don't choose who sits in the cubicle next to us or any of that. We, you know, and so thank you very much for expanding the, we already had a big list of questions. Now we have a few more. So Kathy, please, and then Nina.
Yeah. I feel like I was very fortunate, very privileged to have a profession that really felt like I was contributing as a clinical psychologist. And I spent 25 years working in the VA healthcare system. So I was working with people who had experienced horrible trauma. And that felt like really good work. And I was pretty happy in my job until about the last couple of years when bosses changed. And I actually had a boss say to me, "Kathy, nobody cares about quality of care anymore. Numbers are the name of the game." And I thought, you know, I don't even want to work for a system that would allow someone to say that to me. So I took what was called an early out. They were decreasing the number of federal employees, not as dramatically as recently. So I retired. I retired and went into private practice. And was still able to do the kind of work that I loved doing, but I didn't have somebody telling me that I needed to produce more numbers rather than focus on quality of care. So even in a profession where I felt like it was a perfect fit, both for me personally and dharmically, even in that case, you can end up having experiences that are really discouraging.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that real life experience, you know, where that dissonance shows up. Appreciate your being willing to tell us. Thanks. Nina.
Suze, I want to thank you for a wonderful, wonderful talk. So many of your questions are, you know, I thought about, but most particularly, I so appreciate how you started with that it's nearly impossible to find purity in one's work. And I'm so glad about that. I'm thinking about jobs that I had And in particular, about supervising people. Because not only did I have to come to work and think about my ethics, about how I come to work. In fact, I remember before I got into the Dharma that I would sit in, before I got to work, I would sit in front of the mirror and have these conversations about how I was going to talk to somebody and how they would respond, and which never came to fruition. But, you know, letting go of that scatterbrain talk in my head took the Dharma. But also in supervising other people, you know, bringing care and loving kindness to work is really a challenge, can really be a challenge, because everybody has a different personality and comes from a different perspective. Yeah. But yeah, I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you for, just like others, you've expanded the conversation, because I didn't even talk about when you're supervising or when you're, you know, and how challenging that can be. I remember when I fired a driver who I thought I was being really kind and helpful, because I kept on giving him another chance and another chance and another chance. And when we finally decided to let him go, all the other workers said, thank goodness we were waiting for you to do that, because his bad attitude and his poor performance was affecting them. And I thought that I was being a good boss, and actually I wasn't. I was looking at things too narrowly. I wasn't seeing how everybody was affected by the whole team of people. So thank you for bringing that whole thing up.
Yeah, and I've been in situations where I've had to dismiss people. And since I work for the city, there's a long process. You have to have a lot of documentation. Uh-huh. But I even liked them as people, but I had to dismiss them because of their work.
Yeah. I once had to have a conversation with one of my drivers about personal hygiene. He didn't believe in showering. It's like, how does somebody not have a belief in hygiene? But he didn't. And he stunk so bad that the office people didn't want to be there at 3:00 in the afternoon when he came home from work. And it was like, oh my goodness, I never had that kind of conversation before. This is a rich topic. Please, Lauren. And I so appreciate everybody sharing. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much, Suze. You really covered so many different aspects of working, livelihood. You really did justice to the topic. And sometimes I've looked at it as, oh, what is this? You know, this isn't as important, and, you know, so important, but you really got to the heart of it. So for me, my livelihood has always been a real place of challenge. And I started out deciding when I was 7 years old that I wanted to be a teacher. And I had drew a picture. We were studying occupations, and we were supposed to write down 1970, what job did we want, and draw a picture of ourselves, which I did, and which I saved, because I was so sure that that's what I wanted to be. And when it got to be 1970, that is what I was doing, and I shared the picture with my class. But I had the, idealism and perfectionism. Those aspects really interfered with my comfort and what I considered doing a good job. And what I ran into was similar to what Kathy was sharing with the system. I started out with a system that was offer creativity and you could work in that way. And so that's what I started out with. But I also had to manage 40 kids my first year. And let's see, 40 kids, and 9 were girls in that class. And I was just overwhelmed of how to control all these kids. And I was trying to teach poetry, which I loved, but then I had these boys doing all this stuff, and I felt horrible because I couldn't control them. Mm-hmm. And I worked hard. That made me work harder. So that was my first year of teaching. I ended up, it was in many roles, but I ended up in one that really suited me. And it was something that was balanced. It was on Vashon Island, and it was a time when the predominant, one predominant way of teaching was art in heart in the language arts, and that just, that was perfect for me. I was in a small group setting, and my astrologer had told me that I was much better in a small group setting, stay away from being in front of a big group. Anyway, so it goes. I really looked forward to retirement. Oh, I just couldn't wait to not be a teacher anymore. And I was so happy when retirement came and I was free. And then what did I do? I became a teacher at Sims. And it was always challenging. And the same issues came up, perfectionism. But this time the Dharma is I stuck with it. You know, I was learning, you know, it's uncomfortable, it's a challenge, but stay with it. And I love the Dharma so much, and I learned so much from being a teacher in the Dharma that even when it's not always comfortable, I am so grateful that I'm still a teacher in a certain way. So interesting how things turn out.
And we're grateful too. And once again, you brought in two more aspects I didn't even bring up: idealism and perfectionism, and the way we set expectations for ourselves that are sometimes really unrealistic, and what they do to us. Wow. Well, isn't this a rich a rich topic? Yeah. Stephanie, please.
Yeah. I concur. I forgot, was it Julie that said great talk and wanted to take notes? And this is my first time that I actually took notes during the talk, so I really enjoyed it. I wanted to share that I'm in a regular corporate job, and I was taught from a very young age that, you know, get a career that will provide financial freedom, and it's more about survival. And so there's not much about, you know, helping other people and that type of thought when I picked the job. And in the beginning it was okay, and then now that I've worked for a while, it was actually very draining. When I think about, you know, you talked about, you know, it's impossible to find purity at work, but at least I wanted to find at least some purity at work, you know, like a little percentage. And I think that's what actually brought me to learning about Dharma and all of this. Cause I actually had a VP that was extremely toxic, and I had to like lie to the people on my team. And I was just like, okay, this is too much. And, yeah, I just want to share that. And I would like to find a little bit of purity at work somehow. I'm still searching at this point.
Thank you once again for just sharing your own experience. I have a favorite movie that I watch at least once a year. It's called Chariots of Fire. It's about these athletes in the 20s in England. And there was a Scottish runner who was just the most amazing runner. And his father was a Chinese missionary. And he said, you can praise God by peeling a potato if you peel it to perfection. And I don't go with the God part, but the idea that we can find meaning in doing a job well, And I think it's challenging. It's not just like, oh, that's easy. But it's a piece of it that we find ourselves within systems. I remember working for the city of Seattle. I was the director of neighborhood planning many years ago and tried to work and help neighborhoods become empowered. But the political scene, they didn't want the neighborhoods empowered. And so how do you, you know, several of you have talked about that inner conflict between your own values and the values that are represented by the institution or the business or the corporation or whatever that you're in. And that right livelihood, just like the whole of the Dharma, is this process, moment to moment. How do I align with my values? What am I bringing here? So Sherry, please.
Yeah, thank you for all of this. I just want to follow with that, maybe to provide a grass is greener kind of view. Or I'm self-employed. I have these conversations with my husband all the time, who works for a very big corporation. I probably wouldn't survive under the kind of controlling apparatus of the large organization. But even though I can control my time and I have a very worthwhile career, I help people every day, all day long. And but I, everything that I do, because of the culture that we live in, is transactional. So I will have an incredibly intimate experience with somebody for an hour, and then I have to take money from them. And sometimes I have to negotiate with them how much money I'm taking from them. And how many, even though they'd like to come and see me once a week for the rest of the year, well, they can't do that. They don't have that kind of money. So there's this kind of interfering, set of social and economic realities that are really, really hard to navigate. And those of us who work in this kind of in this kind of work, we're often having conversations about, like, so what do you do in this situation? How do you run your business? How do you have a sliding scale? How do you manage your sliding scale? You know, these sorts of things. It's the sum of what I do requires that I get onto social media, which I would have absolutely nothing to do with if I didn't have to find some way of reaching out to people who, which many other ways to do that these days. So there are huge compromises in all areas. And Suze, it was just so great that there was a moment in your talk where you just kind of listed all of the ways in which it's impossible for us to have a pure work experience. That was really helpful for me. I really felt seen when you talked about those things. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. And once again, expanding our conversation even broader, I didn't even bring up anything about the transactional element of what we do, whether in business for yourself. I mean, I have 7 small business tenants here and have to set the rents. And for years, they were way below market. But then I wasn't making enough to also, get all the roofs redone and take the trees down when they were dead and all of that. And so then, how do you determine what's a fair rent? It's like you're saying, Sherry, do you do a sliding scale, and what is that about? And yeah. And we all live in a moneyed world. Yeah. Several years ago, Arv, one of our teachers, gave a great talk on the history of money. Do you remember that, Lauren?
I remember you sharing about it, but I don't remember.
He's an economist, and has, it was so good. It was during the year that it was Dharma and Daily Life, and each month was on a different aspect, and one of the months was on money. And anyway, well, thanks to everybody for all of your sharing. I do have a few announcements.